The years had fled Ennis Page's face. His eyes were sharp and clear again, his mouth firm. All the confusion swept from his thoughts like so many clinging cobwebs.
You see, this is what the wild magic can do, to heal as well as change. The wild magic is a thing of wonders and miracles, as well as darkness.
And no need to bother with the sales pitch. We're convinced.
Then you must stand with me. Stop these people from trying to close down the rift. I am very powerful, but even I need someone to guard my back. I can't be everywhere at once, so I require allies. Heroes such as yourself and Ennis Page. You know I'm right, Sir Robert. Your politics, your dreams of a better future for all, derive from the rift. If the Queen forces its closure, everything you believe in will be lost to you forever.
Sir Robert looked at him for a long moment.
What do you want me to do, Sir Magus?
Stop anyone who tries to stop me.
You mean kill them?
If necessary, yes.
Starting with the people here, Sir Vivian and the Questor, and Callie.
I can handle the magicians. Surely you and your friend can handle the others. Or is your reputation merely legend after all?
Sir Robert looked at Ennis, who shrugged easily.
I haven't got a clue what's going on here, Rob. You decide, and I'll follow.
Just like old times.
Sir Robert turned to the Magus.
And if I won't do what you want, if I decide I must follow my heart and my conscience, as I have always tried to do, what then, Sir Magus?
Then you should consider that what the wild magic has given, it can also take away.
Sir Robert smiled mirthlessly.
I knew you were going to say that. That's all you understand, isn't it, Sorcerer? The carrot and the stick. Reward with one hand and threaten with the other. You'd have made a fine politician, Sir Magus. But this is not a time for politics. If you'd appealed to my patriotism and asked me to defend the rift for the good of the land and its peoples, I might just have gone along with you. There's a part of me that's really missed being a hero. But you don't understand about things like heart and conscience, do you? All you understand is threats and power. Well, thanks to you, I'm the man I used to be, and my mind is wonderfully clear. And I say to hell with you. The wild magic is, was, and always will be a threat to everything that men of goodwill hold dear. I lived through the long night while many of my friends and comrades did not. I'll do whatever it takes to stop the blue moon coming around again. If the rift really is doing what the shaman claims, it's a sword hanging over all our heads. Shut it down, Magus, or we'll make you shut it down. And to hell with your gifts and your threats.
That's my old Rob Hawk. I'm a little confused as to how much things have changed while I was not myself. But the present situation seems clear enough. Typical sorcerer, thinking it all comes down to power. A soldier knows better. A man has his loyalty and his honor, or he is not a man. The throne is the throne, no matter who happens to be sitting on it. And I have sworn my life to defending it from all enemies, and especially from vicious little shits like you, Magus. So take back your gift if you wish, sorcerer. But you better be quick with your spell, or I swear I'll hang on long enough to spill your tripe on the floor.
He speaks true, Magus. We're Prince Rupert's men, and no one messes with us and lives to boast of it.
Ah, well, it was worth a try.
How dare you! How dare you treat my people like this, sorcerer! They are my subjects, under my protection, not your playthings! Threaten harm to any one of them again, and I'll...
Oh, shut up! Or I'll do something amusing to you.
And with that unguarded remark, he lost whatever influence he might have had. Chance, Sir Vivian, and Callie moved quickly together to form a living shield between the Queen and the Magus. Chappie crouched before them. Sir Robert and Ennis Page drew their swords. Tiffany raised her hands in a gesture of summoning. The shaman raised his hands, too, while the creature crouched beside him, flexing his claws. The Magus considered them all and smiled tiredly.
You never learn, do you? What is steel and conjuring and numbers against the wild magic? You have no idea what I am and what I can do, what I have had to do in years past. I have seen things that would blast the reason from your eyes and done things that you would never dare to consider, even in your nightmares. I am the Magus, and only I know what is truly necessary.
I have come a long, hard way to reach this place and this time, and I will not see my long-laid plans thwarted by a few small-minded people. You know nothing. You are nothing. I am the Magus, and I will do what I will do.
Tiffany drew her power about her as she rose up above the Magus. She hung high in the air. Then the Magus looked at her, and all her rising magic was snuffed out in a moment like a doused candle flame. She fell out of the air like a stunned bird, and Chance was quickly there to catch her. The impact drove them both to the floor, and Tiffany clung to Chance, wide-eyed and shaking.
Oh, Alan.
All her power ripped from her in a moment.
Oh, poor little Tiffany. So sure in her power that she never thought to wonder where it might be coming from. Ever since you came to the castle, little witch, you have been channeling another's power. You're quite gifted in your own right, and someday you might be powerful indeed. But right now, you're just another witch. I always knew there was no way you could wield the power you showed without burning yourself up in the process. Only a sorcerer could have driven the killing shadows from the court that day. Once I realized that, it was easy to uncover the hidden link connecting you to the Mother Witch of your academy, the sorceress who founded it and runs things from her hidden cell. It was her magic you were channeling all unknowingly. And now that I have severed that link, you're just another witch. And your little magics aren't nearly good enough to stop a creature like me. So be a good little girl and sit this one out. Or I'll hurt you.
Chappie was suddenly there, standing defiantly between Tiffany and the Magus, showing all his teeth in a terrible grin.
Don't you touch her, you bastard!
Oh, please, I have no time for this.
I swore to protect her, and I will. To get at her, you're gonna have to get past me.
I have always found you a very tiresome animal. Pets should know their place.
A bolt of black lightning blasted from his hand, only to fade away to nothing before it could get anywhere near the dog.
I'm the High Warlock's dog, you idiot! You might wield magic, but I am magic, and I'm gonna bite your balls off.
What an edifying spectacle to come across in a royal court. You really have let things go to the dogs, Felicity.
Everyone looked around sharply as the Starlight Duke Ulric walked slowly toward them. Behind him, the double doors stood wide open, and a small army of soldiers filed quickly through, fanning out past the Duke to take up strategic positions covering the whole court. There were dozens of them, all wearing forest uniforms, but they all looked to the Duke of Hillsdown for their orders. By the time they were all in, they filled half the court, swords and axes at the ready in their hands, silently watching the Duke as he made his painful way across the court to confront his daughter, the Queen. He stopped a respectful distance short of the people clustered before the throne and ignored them all to fix his daughter with a steady gaze.
You see, Felicity? I told you it would come to this. You're not in control anymore. Even your closest defenders squabble amongst themselves. These armed men were once your soldiers, but now they're mine. They're all mercenaries, you see, serving the Forest Throne for money, not loyalty, and I have made them a substantially better offer.
You've turned my people against me?
They were never really yours. A mercenary will always go where the money is, and they've rather lost faith in your ability to pay them. So I am now taking over for the good of everyone. I never intended to launch an invasion from outside the Forest Kingdom. Far too many people would have died on both sides. No, I came here into the hands of my enemies and simply waited for the right moment. And now my newly born army will put me into the seat of power with a minimum of bloodshed. Get off that throne, Felicity. I need to sit down. My back's killing me.
Not all my army are mercenaries. Most are still loyal to the throne and to me.
By the time they discover what's happened, it will all be over, and I will be installed as the new king of the Forest and Hillsdown. Technically, I'll just be regent here, ruling in Stephen's name until he comes of age. But it all amounts to the same thing. I shall rule here and make the kingdom strong again.
The people will never accept this. They'll never accept you.
Which people? The Forest people? Or the Hillsdown immigrants? Or the Red Heart communities? They might have risen up in support of Harold, that hero of the Demon War, but not, I think, for a foreign-born queen. In the end, The people will do what the army tells them, and the army will follow whoever's in charge. That's their job. Of course, certain subversive elements will have to be purged from my army. There are always a few fools determined to be heroes or martyrs, but my mercenaries will weed them out quite efficiently. A few mass public executions should make my position quite clear. After that, things will go on as they did before for most people, and they will learn to do as they're told by a strong king. Bring the child forward.
One of the soldiers came to stand beside the Duke. In his arms, he carried a sleeping child, his small form wrapped in a blanket.
My God!
The Queen half rose from her throne as she recognized the child.
Stephen! That's my son! What have you done to him?
Calm yourself, daughter, and sit down. You don't want to make my mercenaries jumpy, do you? That's better. The child is fine. Do you think I would harm my own grandson? He's just been given a little something, so he'll sleep till this is over.
But I left him guarded.
The gentleman at my side, with my grandson in his arms, is called Snare. My very own personal magic user. Not actually a sorcerer, but well on his way. I brought him here, disguised as just another soldier. And no one noticed. He killed your guards with a single spell and took your son away. And now he guards Stephen against any physical and magical attempt to retrieve him. Stephen is mine now, and I will raise my grandson to be a real king, a true ruler of the forest and hills down, united again into one great country, as it was always meant to be.
You didn't do such a good job of raising your daughters, did you? They all turned against you in the end. What makes you think you'll do any better with a boy?
I have learned from my mistakes.
The Duke looked coldly at Felicity.
You couldn't protect Stephen. That in itself is enough to prove you're not worthy to be queen. You should have had all my people checked out for hidden treachery. Did you really think I would deliver myself into the hands of my enemies unprotected? You're not fit to rule, Felicity. It's as simple as that. I will silence all the squabbling in your court and put an end to all this democracy nonsense. Power belongs to those strong enough to take and hold it. My grandson will be king, and by the time he comes into his power, I will have seen to it that his enemies are dead.
All the people before the throne, who had been at each other's throats only moments before, now stood shoulder to shoulder, facing the Duke, united in a common cause against a common enemy. Whatever their varying beliefs, causes, or intentions, none of them had any intention of bowing down to the Starlight Duke. Everything else could wait. A few quick looks among them was all it took to confirm that. But politician that he was, Sir Robert still felt the need to put it into words.
This is our court and our land, Duke Ulric, and we will all fight to the death in their defense.
That's right.
The shaman stepped forward to glare directly at the Duke.
This is my home, and I will not see it threatened. Stand down, Ulric, or I swear I'll see your head stuck on a pike.
The Starlight Duke looked unhurriedly from one determined face to the next, settling at last on the Magus.
Well, sorcerer, do you have no brave speech to make? No last words of defiance? No? I thought not. I never did believe all the things they said about you, but then I've always known the value of a good bluff. You've done nothing of note since you opened the rift. My spies' reports were very clear on that. Could it be you burned yourself out casting such a magnificent spell? It doesn't matter. I am protected from all magical attacks by the Candlemas charm, and I have enough armed men here to drag even you down. So.
The Duke looked back at his army of mercenaries, poised and waiting for his word.
Kill them! Except for my errant daughter Felicity. Kill them all!
The mercenaries surged forward, hundreds of armed men swarming to attack, and Alan Chance went forward to meet them, his father's great double-headed war axe in his hands. He swung the massive blades as though they were weightless, and the first mercenaries to reach him died immediately, thrown back, bloody and broken. Chance swung his axe with both hands, and the blades sheared through flesh and bone and armor, killing every man who came against him. The sound of steel chopping through flesh was the sound of simple butchery, and the floor ran thick with blood. The questor's eyes and his wide smile were both cold now, and to those who remembered, he looked very much like his late father. But he was only one man, and the tide of mercenaries swept past him like the sea crashing past a stubborn rock. Chappie stayed with Tiffany. His heart ached to be with his friend, but he had sworn to protect the witch. Tiffany's faith in her magic had been crushed by the Magus' casual words, but faced with an immediate threat to all she held dear, her old academy training reasserted itself, and she forced a calm upon her thoughts. She reached deep inside for her magic, her old familiar power, and it responded immediately. Not nearly the powerful force she had grown used to wielding, but a sharp and potent magic all the same.
Imperialis!
Tiffany sent out her will against the advancing mercenaries, and those nearest fell immediately asleep, crashing to the floor. More and more fell as they entered her field of influence, piling up before her. A sharp, stabbing pain began in Tiffany's left temple, and a thin trail of blood ran from one nostril. Cut off from her unexpected power source, she was just a witch now, and the forces she was wielding took a harsh toll on her. It didn't matter. She had a job to do, and she would not be found wanting. A handful of mercenaries stopped outside the reach of her spell and drew throwing daggers. Chappie charged forward and hit them like a battering ram, scattering the soldiers and throwing them to the floor. And then he was among them, ripping out their throats with his terrible jaws. He glared about him, shaking his head angrily, blood drops flying from his crimson mouth as he looked for more threats. A dozen mercenaries came at him with swords and axes, and he danced among them, tearing at their legs and bellies, moving impossibly quickly for a dog of his great size.
Magus! Restore my link to the Mother Witch! Do it now!
The Magus stood to one side, still and silent, watching the bloody fury about him, but not interfering. His cloak stirred restlessly, but the Magus cast no spells, even as the first mercenaries drew near him. His thoughts seemed to be elsewhere, concentrating on something else, something that mattered more to him than the simple struggle of humans. Callie and Sir Vivian fought side by side, wielding their swords with the deadly skills of long experience. They worked well in concert, as though they belonged together. Hardened mercenaries came at them in waves, and not one of them could get anywhere near the warrior woman and the hero of Tower Rouge. Callie and Sir Vivian stamped and thrust, their blades whirling in shining arcs too fast for the human eye to follow, and no one could stand against them. The dead and the dying piled up around them, and still they fought, cutting down their enemies with terrible ease. Callie grinned fiercely as she fought, happy to be doing what she was born to do, and even Sir Vivian smiled. It had been a long time since they'd faced a threat worthy of their expertise, and after struggling with the shadowy enemies of politics for so long, simple violence like this was a relief, a happy release. For all the odds against him, Sir Vivian felt strangely at peace. It had been far too long since he'd fought beside someone he could count on to match his skill. Not since his brother Gawain, in fact. He glanced across at Callie, and she grinned back.
So, Vivian! What are you doing? After the massacre!
Taking you out for a very large drink.
Sounds like a plan to me! And afterward, I'll jump your bones until they rattle.
Where have you been all my life?
Two soldiers burst past the defenders and threw themselves at the preoccupied Magus. The Duke had armed them with ancient silver Arthames, long, slender witch daggers with powerful runes etched into the blades. But before they could reach the Magus, his huge black cloak detached itself from his shoulders and flapped through the air. It fell upon the mercenaries, enveloping them in its dark folds. The cloak crushed the life out of them with one powerful constriction. Blood and other things dropped out of the bottom of the cloak as it briefly fed, and then it dropped the ruined bodies on the scarlet floor and flapped back to hover beside the Magus, ready for more prey to approach. Sir Robert Hawk swung his sword with unmatchable skill and cut a wide path through the mercenaries. In his younger days, he was literally unbeatable with a sword in his hand, and with his strength and health restored, there wasn't a man in the court who could stand against him. The mercenaries tried to bring him down through sheer force of numbers, but his sword was seemingly everywhere at once, parrying and thrusting and cutting, beating down the most powerful defenses as though they weren't even there. It felt good to be himself again, fighting a clear enemy for an obvious reason, and these odds were nothing to those he'd faced in the Demon War. And Ennis Page, young and strong and whole again, guarded Sir Robert's back and cut down those few who managed to get past him.
Just like old times. Overwhelming odds. Ha! An impossible situation. Ha! And the whole fate of the kingdom in our hands. Ha! I love it.
Hell, this is amateur hour. We fought demons in those days.
After we finished here, what say we kill the Magus? Just on general principles.
Let's! I never liked him!
The shaman stood beside the throne, scowling thoughtfully as his creature fell upon the attacking mercenaries with horrible glee. The creature fought like an animal, claws and fangs dripping blood. Now and then, he used his unnatural strength to tear a man literally limb from limb. Swords and axes cut at him, but he never seemed to feel them, and his wounds never bled for long. The shaman watched the tide of battle closely. Even now, he was reluctant to reveal the true extent of his powers. But when a handful of mercenaries came rushing toward the throne, the shaman called the power of the forest about him. He shaped it and thrust it against his enemies. The mercenaries stumbled to a halt, the forest already moving within them. Bark swept over their skin, thorny branches thrust out of their eyes and mouths, tearing through their insides. Soon, there were only a dozen spindly trees standing before the throne, lightly rooted in the floor. The shaman took no pleasure in the sight. He'd seen too many men die in his time. He reached over to pat the queen reassuringly on the arm.
Don't worry, my dear. We'll see you safe. Scum like this are no match for us.
Please, help my son. Your magic is different. Can't you get my son back from Snare?
I already tried. Snare appears to be warded against any form of magical attack. And I am really not much more than a glorified head wizard with a few nasty tricks. You need the mages.
You try talking to him. He won't listen to me.
When the battle's over, and you and your throne are safe, you can be sure I intend to have some very sharp words with him.
All across the court, the fight was slowing down. The mercenaries had realized they were losing, and that an awful lot of them were dead. They began to fall back. The Duke had promised them a simple, relatively bloodless coup with hardly any risk. Nothing had been said about facing magic and heroes out of legend. But they couldn't afford to lose. As traitors, they'd probably all be hanged. None of them trusted the Duke to protect them. So they turned to Snare and the plan they'd quietly arranged earlier just in case. Because mercenaries are an inherently suspicious and practical breed, Snare got the nod and held the sleeping child Stephen above his head.
Stop! Everyone stop fighting right now or the boy king dies!
All fighting stopped. Everyone disengaged, lowered their weapons, and backed away from each other. All eyes were on the magician's Snare now as he slowly lowered the child and cradled him in his arms again. Snare looked about him, then smiled unpleasantly.
That's better. Everyone be sensible now. I hold the trump card, and I'm not afraid to sacrifice it. I want to see all the Queen's defenders put down their weapons, surrender, and kneel to me. Or I'll kill the boy, inch by inch.
Felicity looked in horror at the Duke.
You'd allow the murder of your own grandson?
No, I wouldn't. Snare, give me the child. This was never part of my plan.
It was always part of my plan. I knew I couldn't count on you to be strong when it mattered. Now tell everyone to do what I say. The child means nothing to me. I will kill it if I have to.
Give me the child.
Now be quiet. You're getting soft, old man. Let me handle this and we can still win.
Sir Vivian summoned up all his magic, compressed it into a single deadly bolt, and threw it at Snare, hoping to catch him off guard. But his magic just rebounded from Snare's wards and flew back to strike at Sir Vivian. He was thrown to the ground by the impact of his own magic and lay there, unable to rise.
No!
Callie was immediately there, crouching at his side, sword in hand, putting her own body between him and further harm.
Don't anyone try that again. I may not be a sorcerer yet, but I've got defensive wards you wouldn't believe. Anyone else throws magic my way, I'll kill the child. No more time to think, Your Majesty. Surrender yourself and your people now, or watch your precious son die.
I think he means it, Your Majesty. But it's your decision. If you want to bet he's bluffing, follow your lead.
No. It was never really my throne anyway. Lay down your weapons, my people. We surrender.
Her defenders looked at each other. Then Sir Robert and Ennis Page dropped their swords to the floor and moved back to stand before the throne. Chance laid down his great axe, took Tiffany by the arm, and led her back to the throne. Chappie slunk back to join them. The creature loped back to crouch beside the shaman, licking blood and gore from his hands. Callie threw aside her sword and sat down beside Sir Vivian.
This is all your fault! Do something!
Hush! I'm thinking. Something is happening. Something I hadn't planned on. I can feel it.
It's happening right in front of you, you idiot!
But the magus wasn't listening. His eyes were lost in deep contemplation, and his frown was slowly deepening into a puzzled scowl.
I always thought he was more bluff than anything else. Leave him to his dreams and fancies. Now, Your Majesty, come here and collect your child.
Don't do it, Fliss. You can't trust him.
I know, but I have no choice. He has my son.
She stood up from the ancient wooden throne and stepped slowly down from the dais. She looked at her helpless defenders, smiled gently to show them she didn't blame them for anything, and then walked slowly across what had been her court to stand before the grinning magician's snare. Felicity looked at her son, Stephen, in Snare's arms, but didn't dare to reach out and touch him.
Very good. Now you just stand there like a good girl and let me kill you quickly and easily, and I swear no harm will come to your child. I have to kill you, you know.
Yes, I know.
Alive, you'd always be a rallying point for patriotic rebels. Can't have that. And don't look to your father for help. I'm running things now. It was time he stepped aside anyway. Those who rule by force should never grow old and weak. And besides, I've always wanted to kill a queen.
Felicity!
Ulrich took off and threw to her the Candlemas charm, the powerful amulet that protected him from all magical attacks.
Catch!
Time seemed to slow as the whole court watched the magical charm flash through the air to slap into Felicity's waiting hand. Snare's eyes widened, but even as he opened his mouth to speak, Felicity drew the slender dagger she always kept concealed in her long sleeve and cut Snare's throat with one expert slash. All the magics that might have protected him were nothing against the power of the Candlemas charm. He started to fall backward, hands rising uselessly to his severed throat, knowing he should never have allowed the Duke's daughter to get so close to him. Felicity snatched her still-sleeping son out of Snare's loosening grasp and stepped back quickly, but Snare was dead before he hit the floor. The mercenaries dropped their weapons. They were a practical breed. Felicity looked down at the dead Snare and kicked him in the head.
Ha! That's my daughter.
Queen Felicity returned to her throne, cradling her son in her arms. Her defenders quickly took up their weapons and formed an honor guard before the throne. Sir Vivian was back on his feet, but leaning on Callie, his eyes clear and the sword in his hand perfectly steady. The Duke moved slowly forward and bowed formally to his daughter, the Queen.
Stephen will wake up in about an hour. The dose I gave Snare was carefully measured.
Why? Why did you give up the charm and put your own life at risk?
He would have killed you. I lost one daughter through my stubbornness and pride, and always regretted it.
And Snare was threatening to replace you as ruler of Hillsdown. I just mentioned that in passing.
There was that, yes, but when all is said and done, family is family.
Tiffany put her arm through Chance's.
Don't you just love a happy ending?
And that was when the wee winged fairy Lightfoot Moonfleet came hurtling into the court through the open double doors, flying as fast as her wings could propel her. She grew rapidly to full human size and dropped out of the air before the Magus.
Magus! They've gone into the inverted cathedral!
I know. Hawk and Fisher with the Seneschal, as I planned.
And Jericho Lament.
What?
The Magus spun on Chance.
The Walking Man has come to Forest Castle. Why didn't you tell me?
You weren't around. What difference does it make?
The Magus's face was bright red now, and his eyes were almost bulging out of their sockets. He swept his arms about him distractedly as though he didn't know what to do with them. His cloak wrapped itself around his shoulders, but he didn't even notice. Everyone else was watching him very carefully and working out which way to jump if he lost control.
I knew about Hawk and Fisher. I always intended they should enter the inverted cathedral. I had hopes of Harold, but he was too weak. And I had a feeling the Seneschal's presence would be useful, given his lineage. But I couldn't see, couldn't predict, that the Walking Man would come here and involve himself. He could ruin everything. I have to stop him.
Then the sorcerer vanished, taking his cloak with him. Everyone turned to look at Lightfoot Moonfleet. She shrugged prettily.
Don't look at me. He never tells me anything.
And so they came at last to the summit and spire of the inverted cathedral, buried deep in the dark, dark earth. Hawk and Fisher, the Seneschal, the Burning Man, and the wrath of God in the world of men. Spent and weary now, dragging their exhausted bodies up the last few steps protruding from the blood-dappled inner wall. All except for the burning man, of course, who was, after all, dead and damned and no longer subject to such lesser torments. They had passed through the listening gallery, evaded the stalking tatters, and fought their way through the coil of dreams, all to reach the sunken spire with its single room and its final terrible secret. The only entry to the room was through a simple wooden trap door above them, held shut by a single steel bolt. Hawk sat on the stone floor, somewhat reluctant to approach it, given his experiences with the trap door that brought them into the inverted cathedral.
All right, Hawk. Don't be a baby. You know we have to go through the thing.
Hawk pushed back the bolt with the head of his axe, just in case, and then used the axe to push the trapdoor up. He waited a moment to give anything nasty that might be waiting inside its chance to be cranky, and then he pulled himself up into the room beyond. Fisher quickly followed him. The two of them stood close together, glaring suspiciously about them. For all their tired and aching limbs, they were almost disappointed that there were no obvious demons or guardians to face. The room in the cathedral spire was simple and unadorned, empty and featureless, except for the single window in the far wall, covered with wooden shutters. Not much bigger than an average attic, with a low ceiling and no furniture, its only interesting feature was that the entire room had been constructed from solid gold. The floor, walls, and ceiling gleamed with their own inner light, and the beaten metal walls contained dark, distorted reflections that looked balefully back at Hawk and Fisher as they turned in a slow circle. Even when they'd been prince and princess of their respective lands, they'd never seen so much gold in one place, or put to such ostentatious use. The walls were perfectly smooth, the golden metal showing no signs of workmanship. And when Hawk cautiously approached his reflection and placed one cautious hand on the metal, the gold seemed uncomfortably warm to the touch.
What's the delay?
Rather than explain, Hawk and Fisher each reached down a hand and hauled the seneschal through the trapdoor. He took one look at the golden room and was immediately dumbstruck. Lament joined them. He strode angrily around the room, prodding the walls here and there with a stiff finger, as though searching for signs of fool's gold or some other evidence of trickery. Things then became awkward, as absolutely nobody was willing to put a hand down through the trapdoor and pull up the burning man. He finally floated up through the trapdoor all on his own.
You can fly? I didn't know you could fly.
There's lots of things you don't know about me.
Then why didn't you just fly all the way up? Why climb with us?
To watch you struggle and suffer, of course.
This room must have cost a fortune all on its own.
The burning man shrugged, and the flames on his shoulders danced for a moment.
Nothing was too good for my cathedral. Alchemists say that all the gold is formed in the hearts of suns, the purest of all metals. What better way to crown my finest creation? Tons of gold went into the making of this room. All of it donated by the goodly and the righteous. I'm sure thoughts of buying their way into heaven never entered their minds at all.
Hawk and Fisher moved over to study the closed shutters covering the only window. Both of the great wooden panels were covered with a single heavily stylized painting of heaven. There were green fields under a warm sun where men and beasts walked side by side, and winged angels with harps and halos sailed across a perfect blue sky like graceful swans on an endless lake. The style was naive, almost primitive, but the scene had an undeniable charm and power. The temperature rose sharply behind Hawk and Fisher as the burning man came over to join them, and they moved quickly aside as he leaned forward to study the painting. He turned away.
Very tasteful, I'm sure. Dated now, of course, and nothing like the real thing.
How do you know, murderer?
Part of hell's punishment is the knowledge of what you've lost. Hell knows all forms of cruelty. Your just and merciful God didn't miss a trick.
Tell us about the gateway. Where is it exactly?
Right beyond those shutters. Open the shutters. Go through the window. Lo and behold, reverie awaits.
It can't be that simple.
Lament strode over to frown at the portrait of heaven.
We must be deep in the earth by now. What's really behind these shutters? Dirt that's never known the light of day, or perhaps a glimpse of hell itself?
You're really too literal-minded for a religious man. It doesn't matter anyway. You won't be able to open the shutters.
To no one's surprise, Hawk immediately took that as a challenge. He'd already noticed there were no locks or bolts or handles, so he took the next logical step and hit the shutters with his axe. He put a lot of effort into it, but the heavy steel blade rebounded from the wooden shutter without doing the slightest harm, or even damaging the painting. Hawk dropped his axe to the floor and spent some time walking around in tight circles as he tried to rub some feeling back into his jarred fingers.
Interesting. Even the high warlock's enchantment on your axe wasn't enough to make an impression.
Interesting. Yes, that's the word I was just about to use.
Lament raised his long wooden staff and rapped imperiously on the shutters with the steel-tipped end.
Open! In the name of the Lord!
Nothing happened.
You didn't really think it was going to be that easy, did you? It wouldn't be much of a secret gateway if just anyone could open it. No mortal hand can open those shutters. Reverie isn't meant for human eyes.
They all turned to look at him. As he laughed at them, flames leaped from within his open mouth. Hawk picked up his axe again.
You knew this all along. That's why you were willing to lead us here. To enjoy our anger and despair as we failed.
Of course! The damned must find their pleasures where they can.
There's gotta be a way, and you're gonna tell us what it is.
Or what? You can't hurt me, and you can't kill me. I've already been punished far beyond anything you could achieve.
Don't let him provoke you. We need to concentrate on the matter at hand. God would not have brought us all this way for nothing.
I think that this is where I justify my presence here.
The Seneschal slowly approached the closed wooden shutters, holding out before him the Hand of Glory.
I can find my way to anywhere. That has always been my gift, my magic. And the hand can open any locked door. With my magic focused through the hand, I think I can open these shutters. That's why I'm here. Stand back and give me some room to work in.
They all fell back, even the burning man, as the Seneschal held up the Hand of Glory before the shutters. And as the hand drew near the painted wood, its fingertips burst into flames. But instead of the usual soft yellow candle glow, the little fires this time were bright and blue-white, shining brighter and brighter until the glare was almost blinding. The Seneschal narrowed his eyes against the radiance, but didn't turn his head aside. An inch away from the shutters, the mummified fingers began to twitch, then slowly move as though the long-dead hand was awakening.
What the hell is happening?
Beats me. It shouldn't be doing anything. I haven't activated the hand yet.
The Hand of Glory's fingers were flexing strongly now, almost yearning to reach the shutters, and it was all the Seneschal could do to hang on to the hand. There was a strong feeling of presence in the room now, as though someone else had joined them. And then the hand closed suddenly into a fist, snuffing out its flames, and knocked twice on the painted wood. The view of heaven split slowly apart as the shutters swung open, fanning back into the golden room to reveal an endless dark beyond. An absence of light so deep, none of them could look at it, not even the burning man. A dark beyond anything seen in the dark wood or the long night, an abyss devouring light, form, and substance. The dark at the end of the universe, where all the stars expire. Everyone looked curiously at the Hand of Glory. It had uncurled now and looked like just another dead man's preserved hand. The Seneschal shook it gingerly a few times, but its role was apparently over. The feeling of an extra presence in the room was gone too.
Shutters that could not be opened by any mortal hand.
Just whose hand was that originally?
The Seneschal frowned thoughtfully.
According to legend, it was cut from the body of the first Forest King, the man who gave the order for this cathedral to be built. I found it in the old armory. I suppose he still has authority here.
What made you bring that thing along?
The Seneschal's frown deepened.
The hand told me to. And no, I don't feel like discussing that. Could we talk about something else now, please?
All right. We now have our gateway, unsettling as it is. Isabel and I are going in. Lament, I assume you're in too?
Of course. The situation hasn't changed. The world must still be saved from chaos.
I'm not going. I've gone as far as I can. I am bound to the site of my achievement and my crime.
In which case, the Seneschal will stay here with you till we return.
I will. The Seneschal looked uncertainly at the burning man, who smiled nastily back. And just why would I want to do that?
You have to stay here with the Hand of Glory to keep the gateway open. Otherwise, I wouldn't put it past the Burning Man to shut the gateway behind us and strand us in Reverie forever. You can keep an eye on him and make sure he behaves himself.
Alone?
You can handle him. You're the High Warlock's grandson, remember? It gives you any trouble. Kick his smoldering ass around the room a few times.
The Seneschal gave the Burning Man a long, considering look.
Yes, yes, I think I could do that.
Keep a light in the window for us. We'll be back before you know it.
No one human has ever come back from Reverie. You go to your deaths, or worse.
Hawk, Fisher, and Lament ignored him. They turned as one to stare determinedly into the darkness beyond the window. And as they made themselves watch, a line of shimmering lights suddenly appeared, spreading horizontally before them. The line quickly broadened, growing wider, brighter, and then opened all the way to form a huge eye, filling all the window, looking in at them. The eye shone more luminous than any star, an overpowering glare that should have been blinding, but they were unable to look away. The eye hung vast, inhuman, alive and aware, watching them. It grew and grew, coming closer, and inside its dark pupil, they could see a galaxy of stars and planets. The Seneschal and the Burning Man looked away, covering their eyes with their hands, unable to bear the eye's awful, unblinking glare. Soon, all Hawk, Fisher, and Lament could see was the amazing contents of the eye. The room, their journey, and even their mission were forgotten, lost in the fascinating vistas within the eye. There were galaxies in the dark pupil now, slowly swirling, vast, minutely detailed. As one, answering some unheard but undeniable call, Hawk, Fisher, and Lament stepped forward and entered the gateway. Once through the gateway, they walked along an unsupported crystal bridge, stretching to eternity, looking out over an endless abyss. Comets and shooting stars rained down through the endless night above and below. They saw suns and planets and constellations, all unfamiliar. A huge sun drifted by, borne along by some unguessable tide, close enough that they could almost have reached out and touched it. But its light didn't dazzle them, and they could barely feel its heat. They stopped walking for a moment to watch the sun pass, and as it drew level with them, they could sense something hibernating or gestating deep in the heart of the sun. Something unimaginably powerful, waiting to be born, or born again. It stirred in its deep sleep as it sensed their presence. They felt the touch of an awful fear they could not name. But the sun passed on, and whatever lay within went back to sleep. Hawk walked along the sparkling crystal bridge with Fisher on one side and Lament on the other, and didn't know either of them. All of his exhaustion and muscle pains were gone. It was like walking through a dream, and he felt as though he could walk forever. Up ahead, the three of them saw the blue moon shining in the dark, full and fat and potent. And in a moment, they remembered who they were and why they had come to this place. Hawk and Fisher stood and looked out over the fathomless drop, then grabbed each other by the hand.
Lord, my Savior, protect us all.
They moved on toward the blue moon as it grew very slowly greater before them. And as they walked, their appearances changed, subtly at first, and then more radically, they became other versions of people they might have been or might yet be. Their clothes changed first, colors and styles coming and going as they strode on. Hair and eye colors changed next, and then the way they walked and held themselves as their ages altered. Sometimes they were young and sometimes they were old, but the differences seemed strangely natural at the time. Prince Rupert and Princess Julia walked together with the easy confidence of youth. Rupert had both his eyes, and Julia's hair was a bright mane of golden yellow. Then there were Captains Hawk and Fisher striding along in the black-cloaked uniforms of the Haven City Guard. Hawk's scarred face had only the one eye, and Fisher's blonde hair hung in a single thick plait. And then they were older, in strange, unfamiliar clothes. Hawk was in his early 60s, and his thinning hair was nearly all gray, but he had both eyes again. Fisher's hair was as thick as always, but now it was a mane of pure white held back by a silver headband. With them walked their two adult children, Jack and Jillian Forrester. Jack was a smiling, eager sort in a monk's robe. Jillian had a shaved head, a mean look, and a positively disturbing grin. She wore leather armor studded with silver runes. The four of them walked easily together, their eyes fixed on some distant goal, and woe to any fool who got in their way. Time suddenly snapped back to the present, and Hawk and Fisher stopped abruptly on the shimmering crystal bridge. Lament stopped with them, one hand rising slowly to his face, as though bothered by some unfinished thought. Hawk and Fisher looked at each other.
Whew! What the hell was that?
A possible future, maybe. People we might become.
And the children we might have? They looked like good kids.
Yes, they did. Though how we ended up with a monk for a son.
Probably the only way he could rebel against us. She looked like a one-woman army.
Fisher looked carefully at Hawk.
You had both your eyes again. How's that possible? We tried every shape-change spell we could find, but never found anything strong enough to overcome the amount of wild magic you've been exposed to.
Maybe it's from a life where I never lost my eye. I never understood those multiple timeline theories.
They both suddenly realized that Lament was being very quiet and turned to look at him. He slowly lowered his hand from his face and straightened his shoulders through an effort of will.
What did you see, Lament? Did you see who and what you're going to become?
I'm not sure. If that was my future, it's not at all what I expected. I really don't think I want to talk about it.
Did you see us?
No. Just myself. As I was, am, and might someday be. You must remember, this is a place of chaos and wild magic. Nothing is certain here, and nothing can be trusted. Least of all, any futures we might see in visions. There's no guarantee any of us will survive this.
You know, you're quite the cheerful sort for a man of God. Whatever happened to tidings of comfort and joy?
Why do you think I ended up as a monk in an isolated community?
All three turned to look as a new eye opened in the darkness beyond the crystal bridge. Within the eye was another eye, and another within that. The eyes seemed to fall away forever, and all three people on the bridge had to turn and look away for fear they might fall in. When they looked back again, the eyes were gone.
Just how many gateways and hidden realms are there?
Oh, God knows.
Yes, he probably does.
I'm gonna slap you in a minute.
Well, let's get moving again. I can only handle so many mysteries at one time. See if you can find something for me to hit. I always feel so much more secure when I've got something to hit.
It's true. He does.
Head for the blue moon. That's where all our answers lie. And perhaps our destinies.
They continued along the crystal bridge, and the universe wheeled around them. Suns and moons of all shades and colors drifted by. Comets rocketed past. Constellations formed unnerving shapes, and huge unseen presences sailed past, scattering planets in their wake. The bridge stood firm under their feet, and the blue moon shone before them like a beckoning finger. They were drawing near something now. They could feel it. The bridge turned down suddenly and plunged them into a realm of swirling, glowing mists. Hawk, Fisher, and Lament were in among the shifting mists and standing on what seemed like solid ground almost before they were aware of it. They looked quickly behind them, but all traces of the crystal bridge were gone. They had apparently arrived at their destination. Up above them, blazing down through the concealing mists, the blue moon shone like the open door of some unearthly furnace. The dreamlike feeling of uncertainty clung to the three of them as they inspected their surroundings. The mists curled around them in streams and eddies, revealing tantalizing glimpses of the place they'd come to. It wasn't hot or cold, pleasant or unpleasant, or anything they could easily put a name to. Instead, they bore an unsettled feeling of anticipation, as though everything was in the process of becoming something. Places, shapes, and structures formed and disappeared just on the edge of their vision, gone the moment any of them turned to look at the apparitions directly. Some lingered for a few moments, like fragments of dreams barely recalled on waking, while others came and went so swiftly they left only disturbing impressions behind them. Hawk thought he saw a great fairy tale castle with towering walls and slender turrets. He thought he saw vast tomb-like structures hanging on grim gray walls like huge limpets. Sometimes he thought he saw familiar places from his past, only half completed. But none of the visions lasted for long, and none of them felt real. It was as though the world they had come to was trying on various clothes to see what would most appeal to its new visitors.
I don't know where we are, but I don't think I like it. Nothing feels solid here. Nothing is certain.
What else did you expect? In the land of reverie.
The sorcerer appeared suddenly before them. He looked like he always did, a short, almost self-effacing man, wrapped in a great black cloak. His face and voice were still deceptively mild, but his pale gray eyes were unusually direct. He seemed entirely unperturbed by the shifting world around them.
This is the world the Blue Moon orbits. This is the place whose light the Blue Moon reflects. This is Reverie. I told you you'd come here eventually, Captains Hawk and Fisher. Remember?
The Magus looked sternly at Lament.
But I wasn't expecting you, Walking Man. You should not have come here. You could ruin everything.
We're here because we chose to come here. Now, what the hell is this place exactly?
Not so much a place, more a concept. This is Reverie, the world of the transient beings, home and source to all wild magic.
How did you get here, Magus? You weren't in the Inverted Cathedral with us. How did you get to the gateway?
I belong here. I am a transient being.
The Magus looked briefly about him.
It's not much, but I call it home. I've been away for a while. Going back and forth in the world and walking up and down in it. We can only come to your world when you summon us, knowingly or unknowingly, and once we return, we have to wait until we are summoned again. I chose to stay in reality, limiting as it is, because it fascinated me. You fascinated me, humanity in all its many wonders and mysteries. And now I'm back here again. I've been plotting this meeting for such a long time, Captains. Not for you specifically, but for people like you. Heroes who understand duty and courage and honor. Together, we have the chance to do something splendid and marvelous and very necessary. If the wrath of God doesn't ruin this opportunity for all of us.
If I'm such a threat to your plans, why don't you just strike me down?
Because it's too late now. You're already here. You must be very careful, Walking Man. Reverie is the place of belief, and a faith as strong and uncritical as yours could make you very dangerous. If you value the continued survival of humanity and reality itself, whatever you see and hear, or think you see and hear, keep your mouth shut and don't interfere.
Isabel, your hair is blonde again. When did that happen?
Fisher's hand went to her hair and pulled the end of the braid in front of her. All traces of the black dye were gone, and her hair was its familiar dark yellow again. She looked at Hawk, started to shrug, and then stopped and looked closely at Hawk's face.
Hawk, take off your eye patch.
What?
Your eye patch, love. Take it off. I have this strange feeling.
Hawk slowly removed the black silk patch that covered the empty eye socket where his right eye had been before a demon clawed it out of his head. He let the black patch fall to the ground. He didn't need the wonder in Fisher's face to know that something marvelous had happened. His right eyelid, so long sealed together, opened slowly, and he looked at Fisher with two eyes for the first time in 12 years. They smiled at each other for a long moment, and then Hawk looked at the Magus.
What's happening here, Sorcerer?
Belief is everything here. Reverie is the place of concepts and ideas, dreams and fantasies and everything in between. Thoughts have power here. Physical presences are passing things, unless vested in some specific viewpoint. Your self-image decides who and what you are here. So don't let your thoughts wander. If you forget yourself here, you might not come back.
Fisher looked closely at Lament.
You haven't changed at all.
I know who and what I am. I made myself the Walking Man by my own free choice and desire.
I anticipated everything. But you, a man who willingly made himself into something both more and less than a man.
Lament looked at him sharply.
What do you mean, less?
You gave up free will in return for something I am unable to comprehend. But then I'm not a man and never was.
So you're a transient being. Maybe you could explain just what the hell that is?
We are many, for we are legion.
Forgive me, the old jokes are always the best. We are what you created to be here. Don't blame us if you don't like the shape and texture of your own dreams.
The ground shook suddenly beneath their feet, and something huge lurched out of the mists to stand behind the mages, towering over him. Over 9 feet tall, it was a great ill-formed skeleton, as much like a man as not, held together only by ancient and awful magics. Blood ran from its grinning jaws in a steady crimson stream, falling down to splash on his chest bone and ribs. His bones were browned and yellowed with age. Blood dripped thickly from his fingertips and oozed out from under his flat, bony feet. More ran down his long, curving leg bones and welled from his empty eye sockets like tears. He stank of carrion and the grave and things that should have been safely and securely buried long ago. Hawk and Fisher had their weapons in their hands and were standing shoulder to shoulder, ready for any sign of attack. Lament studied the huge skeleton, leaning on his staff.
What the hell is that?
That is Bloody Bones. He's a transient being just like me. Some kind of ancient funerary god or demon. It's often hard to tell such things apart. There were those who worshipped him centuries ago, but he never cared. It was his single nature to frighten and to terrify. And the blood you see is the blood of his countless victims. He's here to take you to the present spokesman of our ephemeral kind. I really would advise you to go with him. You have nothing strong enough to hurt him.
Just how many transient beings are there?
Fisher held her sword at the ready.
As many as there need to be. And they're all very interested in you.
Even as the mages spoke, Hawk, Fisher, and Lament became aware of other presences watching silently from the concealing mists. They were moving slowly, unhurriedly, just beyond the limits of human vision, circling the new arrivals to their realm. Awful and unsettling things that watched and studied with unseen eyes. They were pressing closer now, and Hawk, Fisher, and Lament began to catch glimpses of ugly shapes and unquiet details, as though their own passing thoughts gave shape and purpose to what lay in the mists.
Keep your gaze fixed on me and Bloody Bones. You'll find things much less disturbing that way. Our shapes and natures are fixed and determined by long belief, but just by being here, you have undue influence. Believe me, you don't want to see some of the things your arrival has attracted. Just follow Bloody Bones, and he'll take you to someone who'll answer all your questions. But don't blame us if you don't like the answers.
The huge skeleton turned abruptly and lurched off into the mists, the mages close behind him. Rather than be left alone in a place of mists, surrounded by unseen enemies, Hawk and Fisher went after them, their weapons still in their hands. Lament brought up the rear, carefully not even glancing behind him, his lips moving soundlessly in one of the more martial psalms. The presences kept up with them as the small party moved through the churning mists, but they maintained their distance. Shapes slowly began to form out of the mists, a tree here and there, spiky shrubs, branches hanging down or thrusting up to form a canopy overhead. The shining, sourceless light of the mists gradually died away, to be replaced by the baleful, ghastly light of the blue moon. Hawk and Fisher realized in the same heart-stopping moment that they were back in the dark wood. It seemed entirely real, as dark and oppressive and soul-destroying as they remembered. All the trees around them were dead and rotting, and the horrid spiritual dead of the darkness beat upon their minds and their souls with all its old remembered strength. Hawk and Fisher stuck close together, breathing deeply despite the stench, to try to calm themselves. Lament cloaked his mind in a psalm. Hawk knew where they were going, where they had to be going, and what terrible deathless thing was waiting to greet them. again. Even so, his heart slammed painfully in his chest when they finally came to the awful dark heart of the Darkwood, and there, sitting on his rotten throne, was the Demon Prince. The malevolent, terrible creature that had come so close to destroying everything Hawk cared for. The Demon Prince looked like a man, and he had looked like other things before, and might again, but for now it amused him to look like his prey. His features were blurred, as though they'd melted and run. His long, delicate fingers ended in claws, and his burning crimson eyes held no human thoughts or emotions. Unnaturally tall, easily 8 feet in height, he was slender to the point of emaciation. His pale flesh looked like something left too long in the dark, grown soft and rotten. He dressed in rags and tatters of darkest black and wore a battered, wide-brimmed hat pulled down low over his burning eyes. His wide slash of a mouth was full of pointed teeth.
So good to see old friends again. I told you we'd meet again. You can't destroy me, little human. Banish me, and I just return here and wait for some new fool to summon me back into the world of men. I am of the transient beings, ideas made flesh, and we live on long after our every human enemy is dead and gone.
Of course, evil is eternal. I've always known that.
Strictly speaking, we're neither good nor bad.
The Demon Prince leaned back in the rotting tree stump that was his throne and crossed his long legs casually.
Those are human terms, human limitations. We are archetypes, reflections of what's on man's inner mind. We are the shadows humanity casts. We are the physical manifestations of abstract concepts, forces, fears, and preoccupations. Neuroses and psychoses, given rein to run free and potent in the mortal world. We are the rod you made for your own back. We sprang full-grown from humanity's brow, created in simpler times, when the wild magic was all there was.
You're saying the transient beings are everything we ever dreamed of?
Yes, especially the bad ones.
Why do you hate humanity? If we created you, you should be grateful to us.
You know nothing. Understand nothing, little man. We hate you because you're real. Because humanity is real, you can grow and change and evolve, become more than you were. Transient beings are bound by their nature to be only what they are, trapped and limited to the form your kind imagined. Eternally existing, eternally damned to never be more than what we were when humanity coughed us up. But now, you have opened the gateway, an unexpected back door into reality. And every transient being in reverie is free at last to have its revenge on you. We shall all go through into the world of mortal men in all our awful glory without having to be summoned. After so very, very long, our time has come round at last. We are coming in force to overthrow the upstart reason and crush the tyrant science, logic and order, cause and effect, and all the other constraints on our freedom shall be swept aside. The wild magic shall once again hold dominion over every unfortunate living thing. Once the blue moon's orbit intersects with your own moon, we will all cross over and remake your world in our own hateful image. Then chaos shall run loose in the world like a wolf in the fold for eternity. And oh, the terrible pleasures we shall take in what used to be your world.